This episode of Navara FM is brought to you by listeners like you. Here at Navara Media, we are people powered, and we've proven it works. Without you, these podcasts wouldn't be possible. If you are one of the thousands of regular Navara FM listeners who are yet to support us, please consider donating 1 hour's wage per month, or whatever you can afford, and help us make an even bigger impact next year. Go to navaramedia.com/support. We really couldn't do any of this without you. So thank you.
Hello, welcome, Merry Christmas, Chag Sameach, Happy Holidays. This is Navara FM and my name is Eleanor Penny. Christmas is a time for love, a time for happiness, a time for turtlenecks, a time for Rowan Atkinson, a time for running through airports, and most importantly, a time for ill-advised erotic tension with your employees. Yep, this episode we are talking about Love Actually, 2003 ensemble movie about Christmas romance and the impossible psychological trap of being English. I was joined by writer and cultural critic Natalie Ola, the author of titles like Steal As Much As You Can and Bad Taste. We talked about Blairism, feminism and the family, about rom-coms, the war on terror and the reinvention of Britishness at the end of history.
Hello, does Natalie live here?
No.
Right, fine, thank you. Sorry to disturb.
Yeah, aren't you the Prime Minister?
Yes. In fact, I am. Merry Christmas.
Oh.
Part of the service now. I'm trying to get round everyone by New Year's Eve.
Oh. Natalie, hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So today we are talking again about yet another Alan Rickman vehicle crafted in the shadow of a global terror panic, but Christmas. We are talking about Love Actually. To kick off, I'd love it if you could give us a brief overview summary. Now, there's a million interlocking plots here, so possibly a tall order. I'm sure we'll dive into the particularities of individual plots, but for those stunningly uninitiated, what is Love Actually?
Well, I rewatched it last night. I suppose a kind of generous interpretation is that it's kind of a collage piece. It's lots of sort of seemingly unrelated storylines that at the end somewhat converge on one another. I discover that there are connections between them, but it's sort of, yeah, there's sort of like these different sort of vignettes or snapshots from different people's lives, all of them obviously oriented around the theme of Christmas, mainly set in London. And I think the aim is to show a sort of broad cross-section of life in London, although it's questionable whether it actually achieves that.
Right. So we've got these different vignettes and often like involving people with a lot of star power. At the time, you've got your Colin Firths, you've got your Hugh Grants, you've got your totems of Britishness in Hollywood, or like in the Hollywood imaginary at the time, and also arguably still. Can you give us a sense of, I guess, your history with Love Actually? Like, do you remember seeing it for the first time? Do you see it in the movies? Like, how did you come to it?
I definitely didn't go to the cinema. I can't remember seeing it for the first time. It just seems to be one of those things that's always been there, like all sort of Richard Curtis films. I don't remember like actively seeking them out. They just seem to be ever present and inescapable. This one maybe more so than all of the others, just because it's a Christmas film. So it's sort of compulsory viewing at a certain point in the year. You can't really escape it. It's on. You at some point you'll encounter it if you're just like scrolling through TV channels. If you ever find yourself in a hotel with nothing to watch, it tends to just be kind of playing from the beginning of December until the beginning of January. So no, I can't remember when I first saw it. I was quite, when I looked at events that were happening around the same time as it and tried to situate it in a moment in my life and time in my life, I was quite shocked at sort of how long it has been around and how young I must have been when it came out. I would have still been a kid, a very young teenager. So that was quite surprising to me, but I don't actually remember. I don't remember how I first met it. It just seems to be one of those things that's sort of part of the furniture. It's always sort of been there for as long as I can remember.
And with those things that have been part of the furniture, the things that have been there since for as long as we can remember, the kind of interpretations of them can shift as we move through to adulthood. And I'm wondering about how you would locate the causes of like a political reappraisal, say, of Love Actually, because like we're kind of like, it's still a cultural behemoth, right? But like we are living in like, I would argue, on the tipping point between like a peak Love Actually hate era and its sort of eventual like reassessment slash redemption. Like Twilight went through this like a couple of years back of people being like, is it the worst thing that the culture has ever produced? Maybe yes, maybe no.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of very typical of the time in which it was created, in that it's sort of like so much from like the late 90s and the early 2000s, it feels still sort of like ever present, or it feels as though things haven't, obviously they have materially, I mean, but in terms of the kind of like, you know, kind of media programming, the world hasn't like moved on a huge amount since the late 90s. There's this kind of like staggering thing where I watched an interview recently with like Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at the time, or actually even I saw an interview the other day with Keira Knightley, and you realise that they've aged, that they're like, you know, that they're considerably older than they were at that time, but for some reason they exist in our mind always at the age that they were then. I think that's something to do with the kind of like long 90s phenomenon, just like how powerful the kind of media apparatus was at that time, and the way that it sort of then set an agenda that we've never, I don't believe, like fully removed ourselves from or ever kind of like evolved past. So there are loads of aspects of it that seem really weird and outdated when you actually kind of like consider them in isolation. But this kind of strangeness of it for me, more than anything, is watching it and realizing that it is sort of 20 years old. And yet actually, in so many ways, we haven't really like kind of mainstream cultural programming hasn't really changed. It's like kind of stagnated ever since, so that it feels like we're sort of kind of trapped in this like Love Actually universe forever. If you're a person who consumes sort of like middle brow cultural products, nothing's really changed since then.
Let's diagnose that, the long 90s-ness of Love Actually. I was watching it again, and I think about Love Actually as something that I'm just like almost embarrassingly familiar with. Like, I think this was the first time that I had sought out a viewing Love Actually. And yet, obviously, it was completely inescapable. But I had completely forgotten the bit where within the first, 90 seconds of the movie, they invoke 9/11. And yet, it seems nonetheless to exist otherwise in a completely politicsless universe. The idea of the end of history seems to loom very, very large in the universe of the film. Can you talk to us about like that kind of late 90s-ness, end of history-ness that's endemic to the filmmaking?
Yeah, I mean, like that opening sequence is like, was actually quite staggering. That is actually one of the aspects of the film that I found quite shocking when I really like stopped to think about it and was thinking about it kind of critically. I was like, they're in the pocket of like the airline industry, because no one wants to fly in 2003. It's still fresh in the memory. It's all anyone kind of thinks about when they're at the airport. So to open with this sequence that shows people kind of like warmly embracing one another, having like survived a flight, seemed deliberate. But then they actually specifically mention 9/11. They say, you know, I'm sure when phone calls were made, you know, when the phone calls were made from the planes that crashed into the Twin Towers, it was they wanted to express love to one another, because love actually is all around, is what they say at the end of the little sequence.
Yeah, the title of the movie is a reference to a line about 9/11.
If I had a loved one that had died in 9/11, I don't know if I would necessarily appreciate it being invoked in a kind of like sentimental opening sequence to a stupid British rom-com. But whatever, maybe some people didn't mind it. So the end of history, this idea that because we were prosperous, you know, Britain was still a relatively prosperous country, although that's actually questionable, but at least it felt like we were living in a very prosperous country at the kind of like end of the 90s and the early 2000s. And there was just this sense that things were just going to kind of like, you know, just improve for us endlessly, and that we had gotten past the sort of trite kind of political struggles of the past, and that essentially we were ruled over now by this kind of like media savvy, almost like celebrity class. You know, that's the what New Labour were very effective at doing. They were sort of very effective at making themselves into kind of media personalities and almost kind of pseudo celebrities. So it kind of speaks to that, in that, I mean, we've spoken about this before, and you said like it's not clear if he's meant to, if the Hugh Grant character who plays the Prime Minister is meant to be modelled on Tony Blair. I think he is, but it's kind of irrelevant. It's almost like the model for a Prime Minister that had been created by the New Labour years, which was this sort of like, supposedly, I'm not saying that Tony Blair is like hot, but I mean like a kind of like media friendly, handsome to the mums kind of figure that knew how to kind of like work the cameras and be a kind of like fun, unifying figure that everybody could get behind and love, a kind of people's princess of the political class. So I think it speaks to that. I think its popularity, its enduring popularity, is that people probably feel quite nostalgic for that, despite everything else that was being ushered in under kind of underneath that kind of media performance. I think there was something that was deliberately designed to feel very reassuring and exciting to people.
So when you say reassuring, you know, there is this sort of, insofar as there is kind of political content in the film, or like self-consciously political content in the film, because, you know, a lot of it is set literally in number 10 Downing Street, it seems to portray a kind of anxiety about Britain's role in the world. And it's interesting in a post-Love Actually universe to think about how much these kinds of media products, either repackaged or invented or participated in the creation of a kind of post-imperial, but we don't talk about that, newly like plucky British underdog narrative.
Yeah, well, there's the American president comes over. That's a character. It's played by Billy Bob Thornton. And they have a sort of a joint press conference where they update the public on the status of the kind of special relationship, which obviously you're familiar with as the kind of the relationship between Britain and America. And the Billy Bob Thornton character is kind of portrayed as a little bit sleazy, a little bit opportunistic. He, well, we can talk about that in more detail in a minute, but he kind of cracks onto the Martin McCutcheon character, who is the kind of love interest of the Prime Minister. And there's this moment where during the press conference, the Hugh Grant Prime Minister figure sort of stands up to him and says, you know, this special relationship or this friendship, it's an interesting term. And he challenges him on it, and he asserts himself and he makes himself seem very powerful. And I've been thinking about this in, while I was watching it, and how this serves as a sort of counterfactual to what was really happening, which was that obviously Britain had bowed to every single demand that America had made with regards to the war in Iraq. And I think that, you know, even among Tony Blair's most like diehard committed support base, there was embarrassment around this in 2003, which was the year that the film was made and came out. And it was obviously the year in which we went to the war in Iraq started. And yeah, it seems like it's kind of serving a kind of counterfactual. It's sort of soothing those middle classes who feel as though they're still loyal to Tony Blair. They won't ever disavow themselves of Tony Blair, but they will, they probably sought some kind of reassurance. And yeah, this feels like a kind of fictional vehicle for that, an opportunity to say like, okay, that didn't happen. We didn't actually completely bow to the Americans and agree to go to their join their illegal war.
What I'm really interested by in this movie is, I guess, how it would come across to someone who maybe isn't British and also is maybe charmed by the aesthetics of Britishness, right? Because in this movie, you have like some like tentpole actors who have been tasked by the industry to represent a kind of charming, adorable, slightly bumbling, stiff upper lip, can't quite speak their feelings type form of Britishness. And we're really kind of talking about upper class Britishness here as well, like Emma Thompson, Colin Firth, Hugh Grant, all these kind of people. And it makes me wonder what the political impact is of the kind of the effective packaging of stiff upper lipness as endemic to this like plucky British spirit in this sort of new 90s, early 2000s, a reinvention of what Britishness is without an empire.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a really insane moment in it where Liam Neeson's wife in the film has recently died and he's grieving, and Emma Thompson plays his sister. And at one point, like, I think it's like a new thing. I think she's like died like weeks before because we see her funeral. And then he starts crying after this funeral, and the Emma Thompson character who plays his sister like scolds him and tells him that no one likes a crybaby and that no one's gonna fuck him if he cries, which again seems to be painted by Richard Curtis as this kind of like quintessentially sort of like British sense of humor that can be quite, like you say, stiff upper lip, no nonsense, affectionate in its firmness, if that isn't a strange way of putting it. And I think that, yes, I think in this film, it's definitely positioned kind of in opposition to that like hyper sentimental, overly emotional strain of American pop culture, where we kind of divulge all of our feelings and express ourselves, and quite often because it's inflected with religion, you know, kind of pledge allegiance to God and talk about God's influence on our lives. So the kind of, I think this Britishness is kind of set up in contrast to that American sensibility and that American culture. But like all Richard Curtis films, I've never encountered this. I don't know if it's a reality or if it's one of these things that becomes constitutive, like because it's in all of the Richard Curtis films, we start to think that it's British and then it starts to actually affect behaviour. I've met people who, you know, feel disappointed by the reality of life in Britain or life in London because they've consumed Richard Curtis films and they think that that has any bearing on reality. Not to even go into the kind of like classist and like vaguely kind of racist sort of undertones to that as well. Like, oh, it didn't live up to my kind of like Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral impression of Britain as uniformly white aristocratic people who sort of show their kind of minor form of rebellion through like the way that they swear, etc. But yeah, it seems to kind of serve as fodder for Anglophiles and Anglophiles like Francophiles, like these, it creeps me out. I don't know why people would sentimentalize British society or romanticize it in that way.
Particularly what you were saying about the potentially like Christian undertones of more kind of rom-coms in the American imaginary, shall we say. Not that, like, I mean, this is, you know, it's part of the same industry, right? It's really a kind of an Anglophone issue, but like that. But Nora Ephron, big rom-com gal, rom-com writer, written many of your faves, etc., etc. This formulation of, like, on one hand, there's Christian rom-coms where two people are in love or they're going to be in love, but there is like plot detritus that means that they can't be together until the end, and it's the plot that needs to be solved, right? You need to defeat the thing, you need to get the new job, you need to persuade someone of something, etc., etc. The Jewish rom-com is that there are two people who are in love or should be in love, but it's their own like personal foibles and neuroses that hamstring them almost like indefinitely. And you know what, that resonates. And the proximity between like the Jewish rom-com and the British rom-com is so at the forefront of this movie, which is very, very, I don't know, like it's the way in which Britishness is like reproduced kind of almost accidentally through this structures that the film has given itself. Because if you're trying to tell like 9 stories, you don't really have that much time for like plot stuff in all of them, and so you just need to like recruit these characters who like maybe for whatever reason cannot say the thing to the other person, right? There's nothing objective necessarily to overcome, they're just all ensconced in their own sort of slightly effete long-tail late 90s aristocracy.
Yes, repression is sort of a theme, a kind of emotional repression seems to be a theme of all of them, with the exception maybe of that guy that goes to America to try and seek out this really vile, this like story where he goes to America because he wants to have sex and the women in America are supposedly easier. That's one of the like, that's one of the elements of the film that seems very, very dated. Like you wouldn't find a storyline like that in a film today, I don't think. But all of the others seem to be kind of defined by some aspect of kind of emotional repression or unfulfilled desire.
So when it comes to desire, I'm interested in what this movie thinks is, I guess, the difference between love and sex, and how that does political work within the text, because, you know, desire can be a very sort of effective crucible for creating forms of like political allegiance, even if we don't think of them as political allegiance, allegiance towards like the family form, allegiance towards like the idea of Britishness, all this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think one of the most compelling storylines in all of it is the one that involves the Alan Rickman character and the Emma Thompson character. They're married and he is considering having an affair with somebody that works in his office, and he buys her a gift that Emma Thompson's character, his wife, discovers and thinks is for her, and then quickly realizes that it's for this other character. Now, that could have been a film. Like that, I feel like that storyline is quite rich and could have sort of been extrapolated. And it's the one that when I finish watching the film, it's the one that I think about, because it probably has the most sort of emotional awareness in it. But that's very, you know, that's very cut and dry. That's sort of like, you know, a marriage that has sort of lost its spark, where kind of domestic life has taken over. It's very cliched in a way. And the man gets sort of sidetracked by this assistant in his office, who I have to say is the woman who plays that role is a really terrible actress. It's one of the worst performances I've ever seen. It's like cartoonishly vampy in a way that's almost like quite problematic. It's kind of like, this is how you seduce a man, and she like spreads her legs for him in the office when no one's watching. And it draws quite like horrible binaries between like the kind of like staid wife that's no longer sexually kind of viable to the man, and then this kind of like vixen, this like kind of cartoonishly vampy vixen type character that's seductive and is going to kind of tear him away from his happy family life.
I'd love to know more about how this movie thinks about family, families, the family unit, because both like romantic love and what do you do at Christmas seem to both be a kind of chorus of like an easy gotcha when you do talk about, you know, the family through a more critical lens, or even talk about family abolition kind of thing. It's okay, well, don't you want people to fall in love? Or don't you want, you know, who are you gonna have around the table, like sharing a turkey with, et cetera, et cetera? And there seems to be this sort of like strangely co-reinforcing romanticisms there.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly normative. And all of the characters who are not in the sort of nuclear family it's made a big point about their character. So in fact, even the Tony Blair Prime Minister character doesn't have a wife, and there's like several jokes about that in the course of the film. But what's quite interesting is that all the people that are sort of locked in kind of nuclear family dynamics, there's actually always something to threaten that, or something that's disrupting in it. So we've mentioned the affair, we've mentioned the fact that one character has lost his wife. There's actually another affair. The Colin Firth character, his wife is having an affair. So for all the kind of lamenting that goes on for these single characters that just desperately need to get themselves kind of married and locked into kind of holy matrimony and like live happily ever after, there's all these other characters that are kind of in that dynamic and not particularly happy. And I don't know if that's done in a sort of like conscious and critical way, or if that's just a complete sort of oversight on the part of the filmmaker Richard Curtis, that actually there's very little solace to be found in that dynamic actually within the universe of the film.
So in romance writing, romance properties of all kinds, you have this idea of tropes, right? And things are often like packaged and sold, particularly in the romance writing industry, along those tropes, like very consciously. People will go in as consumers being like, I really like friends to lovers. I really like enemies to lovers to enemies to friends, or whatever it happens to be. There are 4 million tropes. And I think those tropes can be super interesting in thinking about like how desire is structured. And in this movie, in like, again, like a lot for one movie, but also not too many for the like number of options there is to love one another as human beings on planet Earth. The trope of man doing important thing and hired help. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, in three storylines, there might be more, but three that I can think of, there is a situation in which a man basically makes a pass at someone, either his junior or who he directly employs.
Oh my God, you're right. It's three, isn't it? I thought it was just two, but you're totally right. There's Alan Rickman and nameless office vixen. Yes. There's Hugh Grant and Martin McCutcheon, his, again, unclear person who brings in biscuits. And there's Colin Firth, writer of novel of questionable quality, and like Portuguese person who cleans his house.
Yes. And I actually find the Colin Firth storyline the most sort of problematic, because he finds kind of hope again after his wife cheats on him with his brother in a romantic dynamic where the woman is much younger than him and can't speak the same language as him and basically is hired to be his like live-in maid. Not to say that that in itself, you know, love can't occur in those dynamics and it'd be absolutely fine, but as a sort of, like you say, like a trope, a storytelling trope, I don't like it, because it suggests a kind of diminished agency on her part, and that can give the man hope, because she's not going to betray him. She's somebody that he can rely on, because she doesn't have the tools of language or the kind of social standing or the kind of the kind of social and political kind of agency, given the fact that she's a hired cleaner from Portugal. So yes, but across all three of them, there's obviously like very clear power imbalances that are kind of eroticized as well. And actually some of the like moments in which they kind of develop feelings towards these women are like cartoonishly kind of Hollywood and exaggerated. In the Colin Firth storyline, he loses the papers that he was writing for this book, and she goes to retrieve them. They fall into a lake, and she kind of takes off her clothes. And then the filming like slows down. It goes into slow mo, and there's this like very dramatic kind of pan of her whole body as like this classical music starts to play. This big crescendo builds up, and then she dives into the water, and he's just left speechless at the sight of her. Stuff like that feels aged.
And I think especially when in contrast to their sort of repressed male counterparts, none of them are like of like an ethnic minority, as we would, I guess, maybe now understand it. The hired help character is Portuguese, and like Portugal is portrayed as like this strange, like post-Soviet backwater where everyone is like wearing a shawl. The assistant to Alan Rickman is like namelessly from Europe. Martin McCutcheon is working class. She's rude, she's rough, she's working class, she carries a bit of weight, oh, she swears all the time. Like it's kind of it's caricatured, you know, because it's a Richard Curtis movie, but there is something that they have in common, which is this sort of like race slash classed sexuality, in that like you're supposed to be kind of more sexual, more earthy, more in touch with like the erotic that can sort of unlock the desire of these like trapped British men in a way that I find. It's just, it's kind of borrowing from the erotic language of the Oriental, which is kind of hard to do in a movie that is almost universally about white people.
Yeah, so it's just making me think as well. It's almost like it's not just it's lots of different storylines, but it's also in the like framing of them and almost down to like the filming of them. It's like different genres of film in one as well. Like the Colin Firth storyline, like, reminds me of a lot of like kind of more like French art house films, all those sort of like films that are set in France that are traditionally played by actors like Emma Thompson or Kristen Scott Thomas, like The English Patient, where they're kind of like, you know, set in a kind of sunny, bucolic setting. That's the Colin Firth story. And then you have like more like a kind of Mike Lee type, like kitchen sinky style in these like domestic dramas where there's like this tension between people. And then you have like the kind of like downright farcical, almost like comedic genre in the like Hugh Grant storyline. And they've almost been like cast in this way as well. And one thing that I find quite interesting is to to like almost like apply a kind of like metatextual reading to it. I'm sorry, but
you're among friends, it's fine.
But there is something also quite interesting about the fact that like Martine McCutcheon, who the Hugh Grant character, that's who the hired help is, she's called Natalie. I really resent that she's called Natalie because there's very few instances of Natalies in films, and one of the only ones I can ever think of is Martine McCutcheon in Love Actually. and she plays the kind of common girl, the common girl from the rough end of Wandsworth. But I'm interested in the fact that she was like a very famous soap actress. And it feels like, you know, those like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DC Cinematic Universe. And then they have these like crossover events, right? They have these films where like the characters meet each other and they're like joint franchises. I don't know. I've never seen any of these films, but I know that it happens. And I feel like Love Actually in some sense is like one of those kind of crossover events between the sort of like commoners programming, because she was on EastEnders and she was like the kind of nation's sweetheart, but in a like very like soap opera sense. And then this sort of the cinematic universe of like the Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, like Cambridge Footlights crowd that belonged to another kind of media universe that made sort of period dramas, et cetera. And then they've kind of collided to create this new thing. I think that that also is at play and quite interesting.
Crossover event is a really useful framework for thinking about the aestheticization of like class difference through British media properties in this era, because like it's like class difference exists only to give people something to overcome in their romantic arcs. Like it feels very again, it feels very Blair years, it feels very 90s.
Yeah, well, this is my whole thing, right? Is that, you know, people talk about that Walter Benjamin idea that like fascism and like the far right is based on this aestheticization of politics. I'm really sorry. I know we're talking about Love Actually, but I do
think no, it's great.
This aestheticization of politics, and what people often take that to mean is sort of like the reduction of politics to sort of crass symbolism, stuff like the MAGA hat. And it kind of reducing whole political movements and ideas to very simple, kind of oversimplified semiotics. I don't think it means that. I think what it means is the, I think that's part of it. I do think that is part of it. But I think what it also means is a kind of virtual politics in which everything kind of plays out in a kind of media spectacle way, but has no bearing on reality, and where that media spectacle becomes increasingly untethered from people's material reality as well. And in this sense, this is why I always have such a problem with Tony Blair and the New Labour years, is that I think that they were responsible for this far more than even Margaret Thatcher. I know materially for working people, she was much worse, but the kind of the rupture in meaning that occurred during the Blair years is very fascinating and I think it's profound, because suddenly kind of class politics became a matter of sort of media spectacle as opposed to a kind of lived reality of people. So we had things like, you know, this tussle between like, are you a Blur fan or are you an Oasis fan? And if you're a Blur fan, that means you're a kind of like middle class white southerner, and if you're a Oasis fan, it means you're kind of like salt of the earth northern. And like Tony Blair really utilized this, obviously, with like all of his photo ops with, for example, Oasis. And this film is sort of that. It's sort of, it says, you know, like we now live in a classless society because Martine McCutcheon has married Tony Blair, you know, and so you've got nothing to worry about. Everything's been resolved. Obviously, that wasn't the reality, but I just think in a kind of, in a sort of mythic sense, in the kind of myths that we tell ourselves and the myths that that are used to kind of comfort and soothe us and also distract us from our material struggles, this one is very powerful.
Can you tell us some more about that sort of utilization of the aesthetic turn in class politics in the Blair era?
Yeah, I mean, John Prescott's just died, and it was very interesting to see all of the outpouring of emotion towards him, because, you know, everyone said like he was a real working class man and he could really speak to working class voters. I mean, the man famously had, I can't remember how many it was, I say it's famous now, I can't remember the exact number, but he had a lot of Jaguars, for example. He was well off. But the fact that he still retained his accent, the fact that he refused to sort of adopt the sort of modes of speech of the kind of Oxbridge educated politician, it's true, it did help him, I think, to connect with a kind of working class voter base. But it was essentially virtual by that point in his life and his career, because he was no longer a kind of working class man. Now, it's also fine to have that conversation, to say, you know, I grew up in this sense, I probably have a degree of sympathy for it, but I am no longer that figure. But of course, that wasn't what happened. And it was, you know, he was almost told to kind of like ham up this persona, because it was very kind of expedient for them and useful to have a kind of caricatured depiction of a kind of working class man. So that's just one example. But I think, it really ramped up. I mean, and just in very basic terms, you know, they completely transformed the purpose of the party. They added the word new to the name. But besides that, they retained all of the old symbolism. So it was using the kind of visual, the kind of signifiers and the language that had been used to represent what was the kind of essentially like the Socialist Party in the UK, to usher in something that was completely divergent from that. And for most people who aren't, you know, invested in, you know, and have the time to kind of study politics at in any close range or any close detail, there's a kind of tendency to just accept that, to accept that this is the Labour Party. I've always voted Labour, without really realising that the party you've always voted for has been radically altered. So that, I think, is an example of kind of aestheticisation. It's using the aesthetics. It was using the kind of signifiers of something in a purely aesthetic way. And what I find quite interesting is 2003, obviously, was when there were all of the protests against the Iraq war. And one of the most effective bits of kind of like counter propaganda to Tony Blair was the poster that David Gentleman had designed for Stop the War that said Blyer. He just changed the I and the A. And I think the I was like a bullet sign. I thought it was good. I think it was quite an effective bit of counter propaganda. And now I'm convinced now that Love Actually is Richard Curtis's attempt to redress what David Gentleman hath wrought.
I think, yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I kind of really love to take Richard Curtis. It sounds like I'm going to fight him. I mean, listen, I'm not ruling anything out, like not on record at least. But to see like, okay, what his specific stance on like not just like the Iraq war in general, but Blair's role in that and like Labour's role in that was, because he is so deeply associated with New Labour, not just through like the coincidence of like when he was writing and like when his sort of films had arguably their heyday, but also because, you know, of his politics and of his association with things like comic relief, right? And there's the idea of kind of laid the ground for sort of charity focused big society stuff that was sort of about politics, aka like about political issues like global poverty, like child hunger in the UK, but also removed into this sphere of charity. So and it's I think arguable to read the Hugh Grant character both as a critique of what Tony Blair actually did, but like through that critique, as you say, a sort of an attempt at retreat into delusion, right? Like a salvage attempt, being like, don't think about real Tony Blair and the real, like, you know, million lives that were lost in the Iraq War, as a sort of low estimate in history. But you know, think about, you know, Hugh Grant. He's dancing to the Pointer Sisters. Like that's amazing. So like, yeah, I'm just kind of interested in what you think about how those contradictions endemic to like the Blair era are kind of showing up in the political contradictions of this text.
In terms of the way that it tries to reconcile, I think that's it. I think the film essentially, you know, exists in a universe in which Tony Blair hasn't made this like heinous mistake, if it can be characterized as a mistake, if we don't, you know, think about it more as like, was he ever going to do anything else because of his kind of financial dependence on America and this kind of allegiance through what had up until that point been ostensibly about soft power? Was he ever going to do anything else? But it was almost like it exists in a universe where that one thing didn't happen. So we were still riding high from, you know, replacing the more like draconian policies of the Tory party that had gone before. The troubles in Northern Ireland had come to an end, supposedly. That had all been resolved and neatly tied up, supposedly, according to kind of official narrative of Labour Party and of New Labour. And things are looking up. And this huge mistake that's just happened, this huge thing that's just happened that has, you know, kind of caused an existential crisis within the political class and beyond, just never occurred. And we can all go back to feeling happy again because it's Christmas and no one wants to have any bad feelings at Christmas.
I came away from this movie because I was charmed by the movie. There's so much that like doesn't work, there's so much that like kind of weirdly like bad line reads and like bits and bobs of bad writing and like stuff that is just aged, I say aged terribly, was also bad at the time, but you know, it was charming. Like I like the bit where Prime Minister Hugh Grant's driver turns out to be a lovely singer. That's a good joke. All these little bits where I was like, I was more delighted than I expected to be. But I am also suspicious of that delight because I also came away being like, I wasn't really like logged on when it came out. And so I don't really know where feminism was at the time, but I feel like it needed to be somewhere more prominently in this because what, like it has this sort of what I think of at least as like a deeply hetero-pessimist approach to what forms of love are possible.
Yes, it does. It does. There's a moment actually that is becoming clearer and clearer to me now. Obviously, sort of at the time that the film came out, these weren't things that I was thinking about consciously. These are things that I've thought about in the decades since a lot more. And there seems to be a moment in time in which the kind of sort of women have made certain gains. There are certain kind of narratives that have formed around women achieving their independence and being able to kind of select partners based on other criteria than whether or not they'll be able to kind of provide a comfortable life for them, regardless of whether they kind of feel love for them or whatever. So we're seeing women who are kind of like exercising a degree of agency over their lives. But what I think this still applies to the present day as well. I think that what's happened is that kind of like discourse has moved on much more rapidly than the kind of the normative frameworks in which we still kind of, and part of that is obviously driven by economics, you know, the economic incentive to be kind of in a nuclear family, to kind of share property, all of these things. That's obviously having a constraining effect as well. But you can really see it at the beginning of this. You can see these kind of emerging narratives. Yes, women have got agency. Women have jobs. You know, women have jobs. They're achieving kind of career success. Although actually there's very little kind of career equality, you know, kind of like income equality that's shown in the film. In fact, as we've spoken about previously, a lot of the women are shown in junior roles. But they are, you know, they're dating or they're, you know, they're going to the office party. They have jobs. They are thinking about the kind of men they might want to kind of, and it is exclusively men. There's almost no kind of queer narratives in the film, apart from when they're kind of the butt of a joke, which we can get to as well. But there's no kind of framework in which to kind of like fulfill that or kind of enact that in a satisfying way. So you're still constantly butting up against this idea that, okay, you're kind of having your fun, but when are you going to default to this role that you obviously will have to at some point, which is to kind of become a wife and a mother and to settle down. And then, like we said before, sort of unconsciously, the film also reveals the kind of perils of doing that. But yeah, there's almost no queer narratives in it. They are just kind of the stuff of jokes.
Mm. There's been a lot of discussion about how Love Actually, like many other movies at the time, is just kind of bizarrely fat phobic, not just because fat phobia is inherently bizarre, but also because it seems, you know, it's just extremely heavy handed particularly when they're talking about a woman who is just objectively in no way, and including by the kind of early noughties standards, she's just not fat. But a lot has been made of that. I think that sort of shocked me, but maybe shouldn't have on rewatching it, was equally how many drive-by gags there were about transness in various guises, and also about queerness in various guises. And that is the sort of shadow movie monster in supposedly a theory about all of the ways in which love can present itself. Very bizarre.
Yeah, but you know what struck me was that, you know, as lamentable as it is that, you know, trans people were still kind of like the butt of jokes, you know, as late as like the 2000s, you know, the early 2000s, whatever, you know, it's of its time. And unfortunately, you know, it was kind of quite common to hear sort of like transphobic, like lightly kind of transphobic kind of humor and jokes. What struck me actually was that how that has evolved into like outright vitriol 20 years later. In fact, actually, that's one thing where the film in many ways seems much more kind of benign than the reality in the world that we live in now. I was thinking about at one point, Emma Thompson makes reference to like a transvestite or something, and it's a kind of like throwaway joke. And I was like, yeah, but if we were truthfully telling that character today, there's every likelihood that she could be a TERF, and that would be a kind of like mainstream telling. That wouldn't be a kind of extreme portrayal. That would be quite realistic because of the way in which that particular minority has, you know, the persecution of that particular minority has really ramped up in recent years. That was quite striking to me, that actually, you know, you'd think that something that was kind of like casually jokey and problematic would have been like, you know, in other forms of kind of problematic jokes that you get in white Western media, you know, media output of that time. There's been kind of increased awareness around how that should be treated and how that should be spoken about. In fact, actually, in the case of trans people, I would say it struck me that how much that discussion has deteriorated since that film was made.
And in terms of things that have aged poorly, I guess in the inverted sense, I really want to talk about the Laura Linney storyline. Now, in this movie, Laura Linney is in love with Carl, like an unreasonably attractive, I want to say, architect in Alan Rickman's firm. Unclear what they do. There's kind of Live Aid posters in the background. And they never get like a romantic resolution because she is in this, I mean, profoundly, tragically and negatively portrayed caring role for her disabled brother. And when I was watching it, like, I felt like the shadow of like the social care crisis like looming large. It kind of felt like a bit of a canary in the coal mine, or the sort of the thing that like troubled what is otherwise like, you know, a fairly broadly comfortable stance on the family as like you know, a unit of love and a unit of care.
Yeah, you're right. And I feel a bit bad actually in that because it's sort of neglected in the film. Like you say, there's no resolution. We don't really return to the characters after the point in which she sort of decides that this isn't going to go any further with this man that she has had this, you know, had these feelings for a long time. So I haven't given it much thought. And that in itself, again, kind of that in itself tells us something about kind of the way in which narratives around kind of disability or care or whatever are prioritized, right, in the mind of storytellers. They're kind of, And also the brother, she has a brother who is in care that she needs to care for, is almost like a kind of like a storytelling like tool. It's kind of like the obstacle to her achieving a romance again, because romance is the kind of governing idea, like the kind of the objective of everybody in the film is to achieve romantic love. And he's kind of an inhibitor to that. So his troubles, almost like a kind of mad woman in the attic, Jane Eyre type thing.
Mm.
You know, we never get any kind of exploration of that. He's just a sort of a trope. He's a trope that, you know, that is used to kind of inhibit her from achieving like full romantic prosperity with this devastatingly handsome man, which is obviously the primary goal of a person's life. And you do buy into that as a kind of tragedy, but also the whole message of the film is that love takes many different forms. Then I don't really like the hierarchy of it, of saying, like, you know, her obligations to this brother kind of stop her from pursuing this romantic love with this other person.
So I think we would be remiss to talk about this movie without talking a little bit more about airports. The romantic psychogeography of airports, particularly in a movie that, as we mentioned, is extremely heavy-handed and then completely ignores a reference to 9/11.
Are you going to use the phrase liminal space?
I toyed with it. You can see me toying with it. It was tempting. Should I use it once just as a Christmas treat to myself?
Please.
I think airports are a kind of liminal space. Would you say that they're a sort of liminal space in that sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The kind of the main action, the main drama takes place in people's homes, and then they enter this kind of uncertain terrain of the of the airport to apply a psychogeographic reading to Love Actually, which it urgently needs, in my opinion.
After having bodied me like that, would you like to? I'm just wondering what I would love for you to expand on what you were mentioning earlier about, again, that kind of ambiguity of politics in this sort of end of history, long 90s Blair era, and like what it means for the film to invoke 9/11 as a kind of tip of the hat to the idea of like a universal humanity, and then just kind of abandon it while still having airports as like a main setting ground for a lot of the romantic themes and romantic action.
Yes, and it comes back to the airport, doesn't it?
Mm.
And because the young boy, who, by the way, the young boy, the boy that says, let's get the shit kicked out of us by love, is now married to Elon Musk's ex-wife. I'm obsessed with the idea of him being in a love triangle with Elon Musk. And he chases her through the airport to declare his undying love for her. And then the guy returns from America after he's been on his kind of sexcapade, and he returns with his like, he's like harem of American women, or is it just one? I can't remember. I think it's just one.
He brings one for himself, and he just kind of gifts another American woman to his friend, who gets about four lines in the movie. So that's nice for him.
But I honestly think this is propaganda for the airline industry. I think sales were you know, they hadn't recovered. So we urgently needed some kind of pro-airport, pro-airline propaganda, unofficial propaganda. I'm not suggesting anyone was behind it or anyone was pulling any strings, but I feel like there was definitely a kind of ambient need and demand for some positive coverage of the airline industry. And yeah, like I said, I think it's kind of crass, to be honest, to invoke 9/11 as a sort of way into talking about love, and then to kind of make it a sort of silly rom-com and then never return to it as a subject again.
It's interesting because I think I'm probably thinking about this because, you know, having just watched Die Hard, listeners of last week's FM will know very well that there's this subtle framing of love versus terrorism, right? Because which twins the sort of the aesthetic turn in politics with also the sort of like a biological cultural approach to like terrorism as a racial category. Now, listen, I am reading this into one line of text, but I think it's an important line of text because it is then abandoned and you spend like the next 90 minutes watching Hugh Grant go at like his you know, busty underling, because it's like a form of naturalization.
You're right. Sorry, I hadn't thought about that, but you're completely right. It's sort of like, yes, over here, this is what we do. We are concerned with love. We don't concern ourselves with this, you know, matters of abstract kind of hate. That's how it's always, you know, kind of terrorism is also characterized as just this kind of formless expression of a kind of irrational rage. It's never kind of situated in kind of political histories or struggles or movements. It's always just kind of this outburst, this inexplicable outburst that comes from these hate-filled people. And there is this idea that what we do here, what defines us as kind of British people, is our emphasis on love and our prioritization of love. And I think that is actually very, very explicit when I think about it now. When I think about that opening sequence and him talking about 9/11 in an airport setting, and then these families coming and hugging each other. It's this idea that this is what our national identity is based on. Strange that Richard Curtis isn't British. He's from New Zealand.
Richard Curtis isn't British?
No, I think he's from New Zealand.
Oh my God, I'm sure you're right, but it's immediately like so jarring that is like a non-British. I mean, maybe this is like an anglophilic imagination. Maybe it's kind of like the most British thing is to be miserable about the Brits, as we are like currently doing. So maybe that does actually make sense, having thought about it.
To be that invested in a particular vision of like what it means to be British, or a particular idea of what it means to be British, I would always suspect that you wouldn't actually be British. It's kind of like it's an Anglophile tendency. It's someone who has idealized and romanticized a British way of life and seems very invested in preserving it as an idea. So yeah, he's from New Zealand.
So final thoughts.
You will probably at some point be forced to watch Love Actually over the Christmas period. If not by a relative, then because there'll be nothing else on TV. I would just say enjoy responsibly what looks like an innocent rom-com is actually replete with lots of subliminal messages that have implications for our life, our politics beyond. And I'm joking, of course, but yeah, that would be my advice.
Don't take your Colin Firths at face value.
Exactly. Exactly.
Natalie, thank you so much for coming on to talk to me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Oh, Mark, hi. Good to see you then.
Yeah, I just thought I'd tag along.
Jamie's friends are so good looking. He never tells me this. Think maybe now I have made the wrong choice. Picked the wrong Englishman.
She can't speak English properly. She just doesn't understand.
Dad! Dad!
Oh, God.
Did you get off any friends?
Matter of fact, I did.
Thanks, Dad.